Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 340 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyrer, your host once again. And today my guest is Brian Lebovic. Now, Brian is a personal injury attorney in the South Florida area. And to say he's a personal injury attorney is really an understatement. He runs a pretty large practice of 15 lawyers and 80 support staff. And you know, frankly, to be honest with you, I don't normally have these types of guests on the podcast because, you know, typically the audience that we're seeking to speak to is solo and small firm practitioners. So talking with somebody who's had as much success as Brian has had is oftentimes, you know, unproductive, but Brian is quite the exception, and that's one of the reasons why I had to have him on the show, because you know, he hasn't forgotten how he made the progress from working out of the backseat of his car, so to speak, to where he is now. And he shares freely his advice and his experiences. And I think you're going to get a real insight into how somebody plowed his successes back into the business. We use a metaphor, the flywheel concept, which seemed to be appropriate, that instead of taking his first successes and spending them on himself, he spent them on his business. And what that allowed him to do was leverage things over the course of a few years and really, really develop something special. And you also hear about his ancillary businesses that have to do with businesses that he started for the community that have an altruistic nonprofit viewpoint or objective, and how that works with in a synergistic way and in a real way with his law firm. So it's really a fascinating discussion, in my humble opinion. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. So without any further delay, here is Brian Lebovic.
Brian Lebovic, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Neil.
Well, it's a delight to have you with us today, Brian. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
My name is Brian Lebovic, and I am the managing shareholder of the Lebovic Law Group. We are a 15-lawyer, 80-team law firm out of South Florida. We do four things: personal injury, social security disability, workers' compensation, and medical collections. I also own a medical billing company, thus the medical collections, and that is a national company. It does medical billing all over the country, and that's called Gulfstream Outsourcing and Specialized Billing. And that's kind of my whole life. I've got three kids, and I'm a dad, and they're older now, almost adults, so that job is becoming more advisorial instead of parental, but that's kind of my kid.
However, I will tell you that as the parent of grown children, it really doesn't end.
Yeah, true. I've got two that are adults in the world. One is in Denver, one's in DC, and then I got one in college. He's a senior, so I'm getting better at the adult idea.
At that point, for sure. Now, you haven't always been a 15-lawyer, 80-person firm with, ties all over the south of Florida. How did you get to that point? Were you always doing personal injury from the get-go, or have you had a journey through the legal space?
I think everybody has clearly had a journey, and I'm not a young person anymore. You know, I'm I'm 58. I tell people I'm almost 60 because I'm feeling my age, but I'm 58 and it's been a long journey. It's been a 35 year journey. I was government prosecutor when I started. I started out at the U.S. Department of Justice in the Honor Grad program. And when I got out of that, I worked for a solo PI firm in Broward as their sole litigator. And they brought me in just to try cases. So that was a great job. It was awesome. I had an unlimited bank account and I had a guy that was afraid to go to court. And so I was the sole guy that got to do whatever I wanted. I love that job, but eventually dawned on me that I could do much better on my own. And I started off on my own, and I started off as a door lawyer, they say, you know, whatever walks through the door.
Sure.
And the thing that walks through the door is divorce. I don't know if anybody's ever started on your own, but if you want to start on your own and you want to do something that walks through the door on any type of an ad, you can just do divorce because there's a lot of it out there. So it's a blue ocean field, no matter how many people are in it. So I started doing that and I got really good at divorce and realized that I hated it. And so we did divorce and then we did some workers' compensation. And I was trying to be a PI lawyer because that's who I had worked for previously. And I loved doing that. The PI field calls to me as a prosecutor. That's kind of my vision of myself. That's who I've always been. And the need to make money kind of derailed me a little bit when I started. And it took me a while to get to that vision of being a prosecutor for people in civil actions. And then once that happened, my life got much better.
Yeah, well, you were trying to start that practice then. Back, pre-internet days, basically?
Yeah. So
in those days, it was the barrier to entry was a little more challenging. I mean, every attorney that I know of in those days, their main marketing vehicle was how big a Yellow Page ad you could afford.
Completely true.
Is that right?
I had no clue that Yellow Pages worked. And so I took a chance and I did the dollar bill sized ad. I remember this so specifically. And it was like $300 a month. And I was swallowing hard on that. That was a tough, bitter pill to swallow. And it brought in literally like 20 times that in ROI. Because the only thing I did, I like stuck a dollar bill out of there and then just started bringing in cases.
Yeah, so for our younger readers or listeners, I sometimes forget that they really don't know what a Yellow Page ad is.
They don't even know what it is, right? No one even knows what Yellow Page is anymore.
What the phone directory was. But that's how we advertise professional services. That's how all businesses advertise. You got two phone books every year, the White Pages, which were residential, and the Yellow Pages, which was business listings. And you could purchase a display. And what Brian's talking about is there was an ad size, literally the size of a dollar bill, ran across the page horizontally. And that's what it cost in those days. $300 in those days, that wasn't cheap.
You know, when you start off your practice, you got no money coming in. You're just burning capital. And it really, and in retrospect, it was cheap. But at the time, I thought it was a complete ripoff.
Right, right. And it's a complete leap of faith because you're unable to target your audience in any way other than with the ad copy and the visuals. And back in those days, it was pretty competitive because there were, hundreds, if not thousands, of attorneys doing the same thing. And so the ads started to look repetitive. So then you had to start doing things like adding some color. I remember when that was.
Right.
That was a big thing. You added red in your Yellow Page ad, and that would set you out. And then people started putting their photos in and taking larger and larger ads. But that's the way you scaled your marketing practice in those days.
So you want to hear something funny?
Sure.
So the first guy that told me to stay in the Yellow Pages was a guy named Stu, and Stu Kaplan. He lives up in Orlando. We're still friendly. He moved to Orlando after he had my account for 1 year, and a guy named Jerry took over my account. Well, Jerry just started to work for me you know, like Yellow Pages died ages ago, and he worked a million other places. He worked like four or five other places. He just came to me and we just formed a partnership to do some work in sales together.
Isn't that interesting?
My old Yellow Page salesman now works for me.
Yeah, it goes around, comes around. Now, it's still a competitive market, and particularly in South Florida where you are. Yellow Pages have gone by the way. How do you market your firm these days?
Pretty much any way you can market a firm, we market our firm. We do a lot of marketing in our area and our DMA. So for anybody who's young on the call, the key to marketing, in my opinion, to start to drive in market share is internet and is doing direct call advertising in PPC and LSAs and setting up your business using that digital market avenue. That to me is number one way to spend money. The other way to spend money is direct referral marketing by going out and talking to other lawyers and saying, I need business. So those two methodologies were the way that if I were to give somebody advice on how to go as a young lawyer, that's how I did it. And that's how it worked for me. And the direct sale then was the Yellow Pages. Now it's, you know, PPC. So
yeah. And for again, for those who don't know the acronym, it's pay-per-click. And so what that has to do with, you're going to run ads on the internet, basically, and drive people to click on the ad so that you can then directly market to them.
Yep. And but we also have mass media advertising. So we do television, radio, billboards in our market. And then we do social media advertising. So we have Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn, and we have an entire campaign that goes on with that. And we have a very strong referral marketing program that's built into our firm that we call the Family of Warriors. Our vision and our theme of being in the world is to be warriors for justice. And so we've created this concept of everyone that refers us cases is a part of our Family of Warriors, and we send them Family of Warriors information and Family of Warriors gifts and Family of Warriors inclusive kind of participatory boxes that allow them to kind of feel like we're part of their family and they're a part of our family, and we try to make their family stronger. So some of our boxes have gone out to our referral sources that let them do family activities in their own family. So that's another way that we market very, you know, significantly. And then the other two ways that I market are through ancillary businesses. So I call it a create a business to market a business. And I've created two nonprofit foundations and one for-profit corporation, all that feed work to my law firm and all doing good in the world with what they do. So you try to create something that does good in the world and solves a problem and also gives you some connectivity to people that might need your services. And it's a win-win for everyone. And those two nonprofits are the Safety for Life Foundation. And that's a foundation that teaches high school students about internet safety, human trafficking safety, police interaction safety, and road safety. Mm. And that's a growing foundation in Florida. And we have 800 student ambassadors in that program in Palm Beach County. And we touched 25 student lives last year with our message. We use the police, we use the hospitals. We've got 42 agencies and corporations that are on our advisory board that'll help us put together impactful educational programs to save student lives. That's the mission of that foundation. And we also created Hispanos Unidos, which my wife is a Cuban American female lawyer. And she wanted to go into the Hispanic community and market. And what we have figured out in the Hispanic community that as a Anglo guy coming down from Dayton, Ohio, that didn't know Cuba was an island, you know, like I knew nothing culturally about being Hispanic. And now after 35 years, I think I'm more Hispanic than I am anything else culturally. That's just my wife's power of personality.
Yeah.
But anyways, so what we've learned is that the Hispanic community is very siloed, and the Colombians stick with Colombians, and the Mexicans stick with Mexicans, and the Guatemalans stick with Guatemalans, and, you know, pretty much the Argentinians stick with Argentinians, et cetera. And you can take those little siloed communities and get to business leaders in all of them, put them into one central organization called Hispanos Unidos, and have community events where all the communities come together in this unified Hispanic community. And we've done that in Palm Beach County, and that's a growing entity as well. And, you know, we've done a great job, and the community really is loving that interaction.
Well, one of the things I think that's really interesting about your approach to marketing the law group is that you keep, it's almost like a flywheel. You keep turning this flywheel and generating more and more momentum. When you started getting a good ROI on your internet pay-per-click campaigns, you plowed some of that back into your mass media marketing. You started getting some traction in mass media. You plowed that into social media. Some of that, I'm sure, occurred simultaneously. But it appears, from my observation, is that you were constantly adding to the momentum of your marketing efforts to drive the growth of your firm.
Yeah. And the flywheel concept is a really, really strong one. There's a great business book on that as well, this concept of building your flywheel and always keep turning it. And as it turns, it goes faster and faster. And, you know, and that's what's really happened.
One of our sponsors.
Perfect analogy.
One of our sponsors, Sam Malai, who runs Legal Funnels. I remember him responding to a question, and somebody asked him, well, how much should I be spending on my marketing? And he had a really interesting approach. He asked them, well, what's the average value of your client? And they said, oh, let's say $2,500. He said, well, I'd be spending five times that per month. And they said, whoa, five times that? And they said, yeah, because if you can get five of your clients, you've covered that, and you've just really expanded your reach. Just keep building. The more success you have, expand your budget. Keep expanding your budget. And some of the firms that he manages are spending, you know, $1 million a quarter on their marketing approach. But
we're spending $1 million a quarter.
Yeah, there you go. Right?
Yeah, I was going to say we spend 20 times the average value of a client. It's a little bit less than that because the average value is about $23,000 over the scope sure. of everything that gets done.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, like you spend, we try to put it, you know, within a budget. When you do this budgeting now, the analysis of what you're going to get, it's really an incredible process. There's a great book called Simple Numbers, Big Profits. I'm trying to remember the artist. I think it's Greg Crabtree. And that book really sets out a methodology for small business to budget out what they should spend in marketing, looking at the kind of parameters of the business that they're doing. So within that business model, you would need to look at total value of the client experience to the business, whether it's $2,500 or $25,000, time on desk for that client experience to be concluded, and amount of services needed to provision out a great client experience and a successful outcome for that individual business matter. So it goes through that kind of intellectual process for a service business like ours, which there's not a lot of service business oriented books out there that are really good at it. And that, in a simple way, gets you to where you need to be to think strategically about the money that you want to spend in each component of your law firm.
Well, I think it also speaks to the issue that in order to grow your firm, as you said, you need to be in as many places as possible and do as many things as possible. So that involves, you know, something of a budget, and you can't be hesitant to spend money to make money. Because if you're not marketing, you're not going to add new clients. And you know, history has shown that you're not going to be around for very long. What I am fascinated by is then you then got to this point. And look, admittedly, some of this is I can hear our audience, you know, saying, yeah, well, you know, if I had that kind of money, I'd do some of these things too. But, you know, you didn't do this overnight. You built this up using that flywheel concept. But I'm fascinated by the idea of creating your own ancillary business in order to establish some synergy that keeps your company's name at the forefront of, you know, an entire community. I just think that's really kind of smart. We've seen this in other kind of scenarios where people will say, well, get involved with your local school and you know, be a part of the community in that way, or a local charity or some, you know, and that's fabulous. I do that myself. But to create your own business for that purpose, I think that's just nothing short of brilliant.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. That's very kind of you. It
has to be heart. It has to be rewarding too, right?
Yeah. So it really came from the heart.
Because if it wasn't genuine, people would see through that right away.
Well, yeah, and I mean it's got to be good, because I didn't know if it would pay off or not, and the amount of investment that I put into, you know, some of these things has been relatively significant, right? Because you've got to fund it and you've got to do this, but the purpose, like for the foundation. The Safety for Life Foundation is my thing. And I did that because I was speaking for a different foundation that ended up stopping doing these high school events. And I had a young girl come up to me. She was a Starbucks. She was at Starbucks. And she said, are you Mr. Lubovic? I said, yeah. She goes, you know, 6 years ago, you came and spoke to me in high school and you scared all of my friends and I straight. The story that you told us, we have never driven drunk. We always have a dedicated driver. We always call Uber. Like every time there's a party, all my friends and I have you in our head saying, you got to be safe. Don't be the kid that gets hurt or killed in this moment in your life. And she goes, that plays on me all the time. And you've kept me safe for 6 years. And I really appreciate it. This is a young woman who graduated college. And I just get the chills when I think about that. So that was my impetus to start this thing up, because we had stopped doing those school speeches. And I was right. we need to go out and educate these kids again.
Yeah, it's a definite need. And the irony is that, you know, look, personal injury attorneys, they have their own baggage. They're not highly thought of in a lot of places. Of course, until you need one, then then you really want the best. And then you have this whole idea of being an ambulance chaser. But what folks I don't think understand is there are a lot more attorneys like yourself that are doing great work in the world, trying to make the world a better place and a safer place. And it comes from the heart. And it's clearly obvious. If you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time, because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. As a law firm owner, you take responsibility for driving more revenue for your firm. But how much of that revenue ends up as bottom line profit? Ryan Kimmler, the net profit CFO, helps law firms drive more top line revenue to bottom line profit. His two game-changing tools are the scorecard, so you can actually know what your numbers are and can make informed decisions, and the action plan, so you know how to get your numbers where you want them to be and drive more net profit. To learn more about Ryan, check out episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, and you can get a free profit acceleration call by going to go.oncehub, that's O-N-C-E-H-U-B, go.oncehub.com/profit.
I will also tell you, just as an aside, I am a client of Ryan's. I have been working with him for the past 6 months. Frankly, ever since he did that episode with me, I signed on with him to be a client. And I've been thrilled with the kind of information and insight he's been able to give me. So do yourself a favor, you know, get that free call and check out Ryan Kimmler at netprofit.com.
Are you struggling to get more clients for your law firm? Are you overwhelmed and feel burnt out from working too much? Sam Malai is a lawyer on a mission to liberate stressed out lawyers. As a legal disruptor, Sam Malai pioneered the virtual law firm model, building 3 multi-million dollar law firms in just under 5 years. As a lawyer, he has generated over 16,000 clients online and gathered over 3,000 five-star Google reviews. I'm going to go off script here just a little bit. I've known Sam for a long time. I am a client of his, a student of his. I took his course a long time ago, and I can tell you it's one of the best courses that I've ever taken. It was so chock full of useful information, hands-on instruction, no fluff, no waste of time. It was down and dirty, and I think it was one of the best courses that I've ever taken. And on top of that, Sam gives so freely of his time and his knowledge, both outside of the course and long after you're done. So, you know, I can't say enough about Sam personally, nor his courses. And as you're going to hear now, his book that he's written. So take that for what it's worth. Sam helps thousands of lawyers around the world create their own profitable law firms so they can work smarter and work less in his online implementation program called Legal Funnel. Over 4,000 Legal Funnel lawyers have applied this system to all types of practice areas, from transactional to litigation. Sam's new number one Amazon best-selling book, Virtual Law Firm Secrets, How to Run Your Law Firm So It Doesn't Run You, gives you the exact blueprint for liberating yourself from the traditional law firm practice to give you back your most important asset, your time. For a limited time, get a free copy. Listen to that. Get a free copy of Virtual Law Firm Secrets at legalfunnel.com/book. Again, get your free book at legalfunnel.com/book.
Do you mind, Neil, if I just go back to what we said a moment ago? Because I want to make a point really
clear.
Sure,
absolutely.
I recognize that there's a lot of listeners out there that will not have firms that can afford a marketing budget like my marketing budget is now. Right. This did not come overnight, like you said. And I have a friend of mine at this point. He's a young entrepreneur lawyer out of Atlanta. He started his law firm in the back of his car doing Facebook posts literally out of the back of his car. Like his files were in his trunk and he would meet people at Starbucks.
Yeah.
And this year, after 7 years in practice, his practice is $20 million gross revenue. So
not too shabby.
It takes, and he started with this concept of getting involved in the community, getting his posts out there, letting people on social know who he was and what he did, having a very clear identity and theme to who he wanted to be, and developing his audience with no money. Like it started with no money. And as he built money, he built his flywheel. And he continued to push money in. So he didn't like take the money. What happens with a lot of young people is that you start to make a little money and you start to increase your lifestyle and
right.
You start to get a nice car and you start to get a boat and you start to go on vacations and you don't have money to invest in. Like, take your money and invest it in more money. You are the best investment that you are ever going to find. No stock is going to be better than you. Invest in you and your business model, and that's what makes your dream come true.
Couldn't agree more. And I think it is pretty wise advice. Now, with that growth comes a lot of pain and heartache. I mean, it's not all roses, right?
Terrible. It's so hard. I'll tell you, there are a lot of challenges.
Business
books, and I just didn't read them until I was older. And so I made a lot of mistakes. But had I read them, I think that it would have been a little less painful, right?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the pain that most developing attorneys have. One, you know, most folks have challenges with staffing, particularly in these days.
Yes.
And I know staffing a 15 lawyer, 80 person entity, that's a full-time effort in and of itself. Tell us a little bit about your approach to staffing and some of the things you've done right and some of the things you wish you'd done differently in that regard.
So the thing that I've done wrong is I've rationalized trying to bring people in that didn't fit our culture.
Hmm.
And I think that has been the worst thing that I've done. And the other thing that I've done is that I've fired slow, where I knew people weren't fitting, and I sold the culture down the river of the firm to keep somebody in who didn't fit. And that never has turned out well in the long run. And my advice to anybody is that as soon as you're big enough to start feeling a person isn't a cultural fit, and the first thing you need to do is you need to set clear cultural boundaries and behaviors that are important to your firm. That to me is the primary step of creating any business. But once you do that, you need to stick with it. And if you allow someone in your group who bucks your culture and who isn't, you know, a good team player, then you need to kick them out. And that has been my worst mistake.
You know, I have a friend of mine who is in personnel, and she said to me one time, if you're letting somebody go, it should never come as a surprise to them. And I went, that's interesting. So they need to know that what's going on is leading up to the very real potential of them being let go by the company. And she said all the times that she's had to let somebody go, you know, it was pretty simple because they knew it was coming. They knew they weren't performing, or they knew they weren't meeting the expectations, and it was documented and it was clear. And so I thought that was pretty wise advice.
It is spectacularly good advice. So my experience has taught me two things. Number one, when you hire somebody, make it clear in your contract the first 90 days is a tryout and they are going to be tested. And if they don't make it, they will not be there by the end of the 90 days, and they shouldn't expect that there's any warning or anything. It's you need to meet our expectations. We're going to give you clear training. We're going to give you clear guidelines. We're going to give you clear boundaries, and you need to rise to be a good worker and a good teammate. And if you show us that you're that in the first 90 days, then you stick. The minute you get past your 90 days, you're a part of our family of warriors. And then it's on us to train you and to work with you and to make sure that if you are going to be terminated, you know well in advance. You've gone through an entire warrior, you know, training program where you're referred to HR. HR talks to you about what's going on. We make a plan to get you better. We make a plan to give you work that's more satisfying. Whatever it is, we work very hard at keeping all the people that we like once they make it past 90 days, right? But the first 90 is hire slow, fire fast. And then once you're in, it's train and keep the people that you've got and keep your people. And what you end up doing is you end up creating a culture that people want to be a part of and that people know they're valued in and that they trust. And if they can trust that culture and where they work and they like the mission of where you're headed, then you don't worry about losing people. I go to these masterminds and people say, what's going on? People are calling my people and poaching them and taking them from me and all of this. And I'm like, you know, that's going to happen, especially if you've got a culture where people are willing to jump, right? Like most people don't like change. And if you give them a place to stay that they love and they're comfortable and they feel like they're well paid, they feel like they're valued, no one wants to leave that, right? And so if you call my people and they want to leave, so be it. But it doesn't happen. My attrition rate is better than the average bear by a lot.
Well, none of this happens ad hoc. I mean, you don't hire and train in an ad hoc fashion. You don't market in an ad hoc fashion. I'm guessing the processes and systems are key to a well-functioning law group such as yours. What role does that play, and how do you manage that?
You couldn't have spoken more true words, Neil. Systems and process and creating clear guidelines for people so that they know what's expected of them and they're held accountable to that. And what you learn about people very quickly is people who are workers and performers are really happy with accountability systems, and people that are slackers are really unhappy with accountability systems. And so when you create those things, you end up having people that don't like being held accountable leave, and that's always a good thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, the systems are important.
And how do you develop those? Is a big written manual? Is it a list of procedures? Or is it online or all of the above? Tell us some of the nuts and bolts about how the systems are developed.
So when you start your business, everything is the creation in the mind of the owner, right? So people need to take that full responsibility when they start a business, and they need to know who they are, where they're going, what the vision is for the business. They really need to be clear about where they want to be in 3, 5, 10 years. What's the dream, right? And you put all of that to paper, and you take responsibility as the owner of being the visionary for your business. And then unfortunately, for many visionaries who are good at that, they also have to be the integrator. And I'm talking about an EOS system here, but it's just basically the person who is kind of the castle in the sky person needs somebody to lay bricks on the ground. And a lot of times it's the same person, and they're usually not good at both jobs. But you got to, you know, suck it up and be good at both jobs at first. And one of the bricks on the ground job is creating systems on paper, literal, like write it down on paper, systems on how you want that business done. So answer a phone call like this and, you know, make sure that we call people 4 times in the first 2 weeks, and you put down the things that are important to you. And you write them down in a calendar of events and say, on day one, we do this. On day two, we do this. On day three, we do this. And you create your systems. And you do that for every single part of your business. And you just do it over time. And it sounds like an impossible task. But as you start creating those things, they end up being your operating manual. Just slowly creating them and putting them in a binder or putting them in an online storage document or in a Google Doc or in an Excel spreadsheet, whatever it is that works for you and your organizational structure, you start there slowly and you build it over time. And then as your flywheel turns, you get somebody in better in operations, you get somebody to handle those things that are better than you, they start to put things down. And then as you get a little more money, you decide to put them in a online SaaS system. So you hire a Learnedly or Trainual, you buy an online system that costs you on a per, you know, user basis, but that trains your people and shows them what to do and is a great like online training resource for your people. And it grows. I mean, it's just
step by step,
small and grow.
You know, I hear a lot of attorneys say, well, my biggest challenge of adding staff is onboarding them and taking the time to explain how I want things done when it's just as easy for me to do it myself. I've suggested that the whole process of if you document that first onboarding session and you say, this is how we do it. Here's my flow chart. Let's go over the flow chart together, or graphic or checklist, whatever tool you use. You're going to find out more about your own business and your own workflows than you think. And that gives you a lot of then seeds that have been planted that will grow into that larger picture.
Do you know how easy it is now to do that in a way that you can then replicate the training? Just do it once on a Zoom call with somebody, you know, fake, like just run through it on a Zoom call and record it. And then once you've got that down and you explain it as you're going through, you now have your training manual. It's that easy.
It's certainly a lot easier than it used to be in the past, for sure. For sure. Now, along those lines, one of the things I know that you spent quite a bit of time doing was writing a book. Tell our audience a little bit about the book that you have and how you use it and how they may use it.
So during COVID, because we have this lost 2 years of COVID, right? Sure. I became obsessed with the concept that the missing component for me was that I wasn't an author, just as a credible speaker and a credible coach and a credible, you know, person in the community, that that author title seemed to do well for people. And I thought,
Can I just interrupt you there for a second? I think this speaks to the heart of who you are as a person, because you got this fabulously successful law practice. You've done these great things in the community, but somehow you feel that there's a missing
insecure,
piece.
Incomplete,
insecure.
No doubt. Insecure, no doubt.
I need to be an author. Come on now.
Right. And that's and it's funny, but I like teaching. I really do. I like teaching. I like preaching. Somebody just asked, I spoke at Brain Trust Legal, which is a big Brain Trust seminar out in Vegas a couple of weeks ago. And they had this question, like, what would you be if you couldn't be a trial lawyer? And I was like, I think that I would probably want to be like a Baptist preacher. Because I love that concept of preaching. I just love it. It's not my heritage, but man, I love Joel Osteen and like listening to
there
it.
There you go, right.
So anyways, yeah. So yeah, whatever you want to call it, but I thought it would be fun to do. I had a time during COVID. I sat at home obsessively working, you know, basically from like 6 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock in the morning. And so I wrote this book, and the concept of the book was this, is that as the law firm has grown, and as you do this, you know, kind of mass media advertising, you get a lot of people calling for a lot of reasons, and you can't handle, you don't want to handle most of those cases. You've got to sift through a lot of people's problems that you're not going to be able to help and tell them no. There's a lot of no's before you get a couple of yeses. So that's one of the reasons that people hate, you know, this mass media advertising gig, because the sifting of those human beings and giving them solutions is hard. And I thought it would be great if we had a great solution to provide for them on how to do their own injury case, since that's what I know how to do best in the firm. And so we did basically, you know, do your own injury case for dummies. I did it in a very storytelling, conversational style. And it's basically how to run your own injury case from a trial lawyer's perspective, if they're giving you like the real inside scoop on what you can do and what you can't do. And I think it came out really well. It's very easy to read. It's conversational. It's not too long. It's, you know, and it's, you can get it on Amazon. It was an Amazon bestseller, which was fun.
Give us the full name.
It's called, it's called Not a Good Neighbor, A Trial Lawyer's Guide to Handling Your Own Injury Case and Saving the Attorney's Fees.
I love it. I love it. And how, so you make this available to clients that perhaps don't have a case that is something that you want to take on. Would other attorneys benefit from this book?
It's funny because I didn't think they would, but I've had some young attorneys that I've given it to just to, you know, kind of show off and say, hey, we want you to be a part of our group. And if you have, you know, cases you need help on, we're here for you. Here's a book, you know, that I wrote. I hope you enjoy it. And some of them have written me back and said, I really learned a lot in your book. Like they read it and they'll tell me things in the book that they've learned about, like how to handle clients, how to handle insurance adjusters, how to handle property damage matters. I mean, there's a lot of little nuanced things that you learn over time. And I didn't really withhold anything on how I do it in the book. So,
yeah. So I think it would be beneficial if you are just starting out and you fancy yourself as a personal injury attorney, that, you know, there's no substitute for a mentor. And if the mentor can be in the pages of a book that you can refer to at any time, I think those are the magic pills, right? Books.
So I've got one client who continues to use the book for his own injury cases, and he settled one recently for 40 grand. So he was super happy with himself.
I'll bet. I'll bet. All right, Brian. Well, listen, it's been fascinating. Can't wait to come down to Florida and meet you. Tell our audience how they might best be able to reach out to you and follow up with anything else that you had to offer today.
So the easiest way to get to me is my last name, which is Labovic, Labovick. So Labovick. And if you type that into any browser, any social media, anything, you're going to find me relatively quickly. You may find a couple of other Labovics out there, but they won't be lawyers. So I am the singular lawyer in the country with that last name, and you can find me easily.
All right. Look for that.
And you can even dial it, 866-LABOVICK. That's my phone number.
And look for that handsome visage on all the social media platforms.
I took one good picture in my life, and it's on every billboard.
It's on every one.
It's the only one I've ever taken that makes me look decent. But yeah, thank you.
I'm guilty of it. I'm still using the free photo I got at the AVO conference in Vegas about 5 years ago.
I think I got one of those too. I think I had one good picture there too. It might be that picture that I'm using.
Yeah, I remember I'd been in the casino. My appointment for the photo was later in the evening. I had a little twinkle in my eye, which might not have been entirely self-made. And it was a great photo. I still use it. So I get the idea. Well, Brian, thanks a lot for taking the time to be with us today on The Law Entrepreneur. I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much, Neil. It was great. And I look forward to seeing you in South Florida.
Well, there you have it, boys and girls, another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode, our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them. And I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO. As I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client. And then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.